Raven and Scribe are at High Point, North Carolina at StellarCon. Here is the panel on the creation of modern fantasy.
I guess I would push it a little earlier, or quite a lot earlier. I tend to think of Tolkien as the first, as the beginning of modern fantasy. And partly because I think so much of what came immediately after Tolkien was very clearly derivative of his model, and I think that most of where he was getting his inspiration was clearly not modern. You know, I think obviously he's with Beowulf and medieval English tradition, but also Chaucer and Shakespeare and all those guys. So I think that a lot of the impulses for where he was coming from are considerably older. But I think that actually until relatively recently, I think Tolkien was still the gold standard for not just quality within fantasy, but for defining what the genre is. It seemed, and to be honest, it's one of the reasons that for a while in my youth, I kind of moved away from fantasy because it seemed like if it didn't have dwarves and trolls and what have you, then it wasn't fantasy somehow. And there was a sense of people repeating his tropes over and over. And I think that some fantasy still do. It doesn't interest me very much.
I want to actually follow up on something that I want to let the other panelists, but I just to be thinking about it, you said up until very recently. I'd be interested to know what you think of as very recently, what the change might be.
Yeah, so do I.
Well, actually, I agree with AJ when you said, what do we consider modern fantasy? It pretty much, Tolkien is modern fantasy just because he started doing something before anybody else did. Up until that point, we had folklore and we had fairy tales, and that was generally what everybody considered fantasy. And then, you know, Tolkien came out with this amazing epic story, and everybody said, oh, gee, well, maybe grown-ups can read that. So, you know, it did change things. But I also see almost new modern fantasy these days with the way that urban fantasy has come up and become its own genre. It's not even fantasy anymore in my thoughts. I mean, you know, we still have the big door stoppers with the trolls and the dwarves and the unicorns and that kind of thing. And I never wanted to write that. I'm like you. I just get tired of the dwarves and the unicorns running around. But at the same time, you know, what was there, you know, and we had things for a while, but then urban fantasy stepped in and kind of took that worry and has made itself a whole, it's not even I don't even call it a subgenre of fantasy anymore. It's its own genre. So that might also be a new modern fantasy as well. So,
well, to be honest, I was kind of tripped up by the word modern. And I was so glad he mentioned Tolkien, because I was like, that's who I cut my teeth on, was Tolkien. But I also very much respect the works of C.S. Lewis, because he really expanded upon all the different, you know, variety that is available in the fantasy genre, other than just the trolls and the, you know, he really kind of took it a little further, I think. As far as anything recent, I'm also the same thing as, like, I am currently endeavoring to write my very first epic fantasy novel series called The Redemption Chronicles, and I didn't want to be in that trap of the trolls and the, you know, the thing, although I do have my the one big showpiece, the dragon, in there, but I wanted it to be different, I wanted it to be unique, I wanted it to be fresh, and not rehash old, you know, same things, but do you still have the main themes of what makes a fantasy, I think.
Gotcha. Good. The first thing I thought of was Tolkien, and then I pulled back just a little bit, so I'm going to just give a couple of quick shout-outs to, I think, a couple of people that had to happen in order to not necessarily have Tolkien do what he did, but have readers ready for Tolkien to do what he did. And I think they all share something, some common things, including the fact they were all antiquarians. They were all engaged in things like reading, you know, epic classic works in the original language, many of them translated the stuff, reading medieval texts. That would be people like William Morris, who was involved with the Arthurian stuff as well, writing, and he was also engaged in, he was writing against H.G. Wells, people like that, so he was kind of setting the stage. Lord Dunsany, was also involved in pulling together classic works and repackaging them and then going on to influence people like Lovecraft and lots of people who followed. E.R. Edison, the Worm Ouroboros, works that were big and epic and pulling from classical mythology and older texts. And Mervyn Peake. Mervyn Peake is kind of coming up to the Tolkien point, but with his Gorn and Gas stuff, also is trying to do something new. But I would say those is kind of proto leading into.
There's been a resurgence in popularity for Mervyn Peake. I've noticed people are finding him and going, "Why didn't anybody tell me about this man?"
So that's some fun. Secret.
Yeah.
When was he publishing?
He was born in 1911, and he was publishing from the 30s and 40s on. The last was 59 that came out. So he was contemporary.
Before all those people got published, though, I think the first fantasy novel truly was The Wizard of Oz. It was the first fantasy adventure group. It was a bunch of friends going on an epic quest. It was the go here, get that for me, adventure. So I think The Wizard of Oz is where fantasy began, and everything else is a predecessor from it.
Our fantasy? No. The lady in my head. Is Lise or? Oh, it's gone. I'm sorry. I can't think of it.
When it comes back,
Suddenly yell it out. So.
Panelists?
There's the question of Mary Shelley.
She was science.
I wouldn't agree with that.
As far as the first female,
it certainly wouldn't
one of the most prolific, I would think, is Mercedes Lackey.
Yeah, but she's not.
But
first.
She's not the
no.
first.
No.
Lud in the Mist. Who wrote Lud in the Mist?
But science fiction wasn't a category when Mary Shelley was writing. She couldn't be considered that.
She'd be considered horror, if not science fiction.
Right, maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of sort of the emergence of that sort of 19th century tradition that includes Bram Stoker and Stevenson and people like that. But yeah, I mean, I think sci-fi as a category just doesn't really, where does that come into being? Not till later.
I think historians of the genre look back and claim her because she based both Frankenstein and The Last Man on scientific principles, so kind of retroactively going back to claim her. But if you go back, then couldn't people like Anne Radcliffe, who were writing the fantastic gothic stories that had the elements of the supernatural? I mean, she's so huge that Jane Austen has to write a parody of her, right?
This comes back to something you were saying before about when you said you wanted to come back to the question of where.
Please do.
I think for me the issue with Tolkien particularly is that, as I said, that for a while his success as a fantasy writer ossified the genre. It made it so that there wasn't a tremendous amount of flexibility, and fantasy became very specifically recognizable according to certain characteristics. What I think we get when we start talking about people like Jim Butcher and a bunch of stuff that's come out in the last 25, 30 years is that we start to move away from that very absolute notion of what fantasy is and start to combine it with other genres. And I think that your sense of the gothic, your sense of detective fiction, noir fiction, so much of modern urban fantasy is really a kind of fusion of traditional fantasy elements with noir storytelling and
horror.
And horror, Anne Rice becomes a factor in that kind of thing. And so the lines between genres become a lot fuzzier, a lot less easy to nail down, which I think is a good thing, and it facilitates the generation of more radically different stuff. And not the sense that the grand irony of fantasy in the 60s and 70s was that it wasn't very imaginative. Because it was so, you know, formulaic, it seems to me. I mean, in my humble
opinion. And one of the splits off of that, you could also argue, going again with bringing in other genres, is taking it to young adult. So you have the
right.
people like Madeline Lingle, who then go to the people like Susan Cooper,
yeah.
then go to the people, and you have this whole tradition of the epic fantasy that's particularly pitched at an adolescent.
But then aren't you taking it back to young adult? Because your stories like Peter Pan and Wizard of Oz and the C.S. Lewis stuff,
right.
one of the things that made Tolkien a watershed moment was that it was successful fantasy just written for and openly read by grown-ups.
So was Harry Potter series, though. That was
well, yeah, 50
intended
years
for
later.
Children, but adults embraced it.
But yeah,
they had different covers for like the adult version of Harry Potter, and then like the young adult books had a different cover.
But I mean, you're making a historical point, right?
Yeah, my
right.
point, my,
right.
my point is you're talking about a shift, and it's more a circle than it rather than taking a fork in the road. It's more going back to kind of where the genre started, because we've always had fairy tales
yes.
and bedtime stories and things like that, and aside from some historical precedent where they were performed for adults, Midsummer, Tempest,
right.
a few things like that. Most of that was geared toward children. And that was one of the things that made Tolkien.
And I mean, I don't know if you guys know it, but one of the most famous lectures ever given on medieval literature is Tolkien's The Monsters and the Critics, right? About Beowulf and his sort of attempt to reclaim the seriousness of purpose of those Anglo-Saxon poems for an audience who were thinking in terms of anything with dragons and magic and stuff like that is childish. It can't be taken seriously. And so, you know, that it's a great lecture as a study on how to discover intellectual and aesthetic value within something that people generally consider unworthy of serious adult attention.
If I'm not mistaken, the original fairy tales were very dark.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even though they were, quote unquote, designed for children, they were designed for children to prepare them for the horrors of their reality.
That's what is so awful to me is was discovering that the original fairy tales were so much darker and better. You know, it's so much more fun to read about Red Riding Hood being swallowed by the wolf and then had to be cut out of him instead of, oh, Red Riding Hood ran off into the woods and found help. Yay!
No.
You know, and that may work as a cautionary tale for our time, but it's still not, it doesn't make as good a story.
And that goes back to what you're saying about working in cycles, because you've got the Brothers Grimm trying to make these a little more child-friendly and sort of Disney-fy them, if I can use that as a verb. Whereas you go back to the earlier versions, and the earliest extant version we have of Sleeping Beauty. Sleeping Beauty wakes up because her babies start to nurse.
Yes.
Well, how does she have babies? Prince Charming came along, found her unconscious, and wasn't very charming.
Yeah.
And 9 months later, she gives birth. And so this assumed that the kids knew a whole lot of stuff.
So
telling the children.
So she slipped through the childbirth.
She did. It does make you wonder, doesn't it? Tough ladies.
Welcome
how many
to breast
that's the fantasy part.
I never realized nursing was so painful.
So
I've not been doing it right.
Yeah. So one of the issues that seems to be kind of under the surface here, let's talk about if we've got kind of modern fantasy, then we've got modern fantasy going in different directions. You've already brought up, for example, urban fantasy, these sorts of things. What then would you say is post-modern fantasy or the postmodern fantasies, the different ways fantasy is going now? And who would you say, or what works would you say are the origin points for those?
And when you say postmodern,
you
do
can,
you mean theoretically postmodern, or do
you
mean...
You can take that postmodern or postmodern. You can take that however you'd like to. Start wherever you want.
Okay. Postmodern fantasy.
We know something that I think is happening a lot, and this is a direct reaction to what AJ was saying about fantasy being just European, just feudal, just, you know, certain culture was all fantasy was. Nowadays, you're starting to see fantasy written from the point of view of cultures that haven't been as well advertised, for lack of a better word. Fantasies that take place in China. Liz, oh shucks, I'm sorry y'all, it's Friday night and I'm, but they're setting fantasies in China. They're setting fantasies in Middle Eastern cultures, and they're taking those folklores and bringing them into the story instead of just your standard fire-breathing dragon. And it's really kind of exciting because we've got an entire world to draw from. And so it's ridiculous to think that fantasy can only be about one little tiny portion of it. And and I'm also starting to see fantasy set within the cultures of the United States, the ancient native cultures of the United States, which I think is very exciting, and I can't wait to read some of it. So.
Okay, I think, I'm going to preface this with I don't read a lot of fiction, so based on my very limited bubble experience of fiction, I think that because of these hard economic times, people are going to start wanting to go for the warm fuzzy. They want their bowl of mashed potatoes and corn, and I think people are going to start retreating back, and there's going to be a homespun movement, and people are going to start to pull back on what they know. And I think you're going to see, this is going somewhere, you're going to see more of your traditional tales with a more modern setting. I think people are going to take, for lack of a better example, Red Riding Hood and modernize it. It may not be a little girl going to her grandmother's house. It may be a girl, codename Red, having to take the package to grandma's house. I think we're going to start taking what we find, you know, our comforts, and we're going to start to try to bring them to us. Just, I don't know, that's all I got. It's Friday night.
The ABC series, Once Upon a Time. I'm enjoying that immensely,
yeah,
because they are taking stuff that you know, like, the back of your hand, like, whoa, wait a minute, that's not the Snow White, or that's not the, you know, that's not the one I remember, but this is really cool, you know, I really like it.
Yeah, who else is sitting there on Sunday night going, okay, I just know he's the huntsman. I know. I'm guessing who they are, yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
And it's neat because they've kind of reversed it. Instead of you living in the fantasy land, they're living in the real world, trying to rediscover their fantasy roots, which is kind of a unique little twist on it, too, because, you know, these are, and I just find it really fascinating.
I think, you know, if we're talking about postmodern fantasy in the sense of postmodern as something that rethinks the way that narrative functions, for example, in literary terms, then I would include people like Neil Gaiman, who are doing some of the stuff that you're talking about in terms of revisioning and
mm-hmm.
rethinking about mythic culture and such like that, but also just taking traditional stories and tweaking them to foreground the narrative technique itself so that you're aware of the storytelling where you used to simply be within the storytelling, you know what I mean? And I you know, in film, obviously, I don't know, Blade Runner, what's the Schwarzenegger movie with Total Recall is the one I was thinking of.
Oh,
in terms of as a sort of postmodern narrative.
So you're saying Philip K. Dick?
Yeah, in which you're invited to question the reality of what you're experiencing,
right,
through character perspective or through something about the way the story functions that undermines your sense of reality and prevents you from being completely.
There's a series on the Science Channel called Prophets of Science Fiction, and they ran a special on Dick about a month ago that was really interesting.
You
and
can't say that with a straight face, but go on.
I can.
I can't say that with a straight face.
But they talked about how Philip Dick re-envisioned science fiction and how his characters looked at the world differently, partly because he was schizophrenic.
Right.
Or high. Or both.
Depended on the day.
Mm-hmm. I think he was always schizophrenic. High depended on the day.
No, he had good days. He had good days. He, Tim Powers and he were very good friends, and Tim Powers fan forever, so by extension, I know a little bit about Tim, but yeah.
But it's that self-consciousness as well. I think anything Joss Whedon ever writes is postmodern.
Yeah.
Because there's a sensibility in which the viewer is always conscious that what they're watching isn't strictly real, that there's a kind of authorial voice within the characters, you know?
Even in Toy Story, that came across.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Joss Whedon accomplishes that by constantly having his characters undercut their own emotional moments with something funny.
What do you think is the relationship between where the modern genre is going now and the phenomenon of both young adult publishing as its own separate track and, as has already been brought up, the either new or very old, depending on how you look at it, phenomenon, the crossover reader, of adults going and reading these works that are originally marketed, at least, for a young adult audience?
The whole young adult phenomenon kind of throws me. I spent some time as a young adult librarian in a middle school. And so, you know, I read everything that there was that I could get my hands on because for one thing, my kids needed to know what I wanted them to read, what I thought was good. And so I couldn't very well recommend things if I had no idea what the book's about. So part of my job entailed reading everything that I could find in the library that remotely interested me. And the way that it has suddenly become a genre unto itself kind of throws me, because if it's all adults reading it, is it young adult anymore? Or it's written for that age group, but then we're also finding that a lot of it is not written for the middle school age group. That's now called middle grade, and then we have young adult, and that's high school, where there are some young adults a few years back that were actually for middle grade, and it starts to go round and round, and it confuses me sometimes, because I'm not exactly sure where it's going to end up. But it's interesting. I'm enjoying watching what happens and reading the stuff.
What's the ALA classification of young adult? Because I had heard it was a combination of word count, subject, genre, and the age of the main character.
I don't know ALAs.
Well, I was on a panel just a few months ago with some YA authors. They were talking about what makes it, and they were talking about issues like curse words and such, and word count and such. And the only thing they came down to agreeing on was the age of the protagonist.
That's not legitimate.
Which brings up the question of being confused, because I think of classic works of science fiction that were marketed as mainstream science fiction, things like Dune, things like Ender's Game, things like Parable of the Sower, where you have teenage or younger protagonists. And I have seen every single one of those reissued and put in YA sections now. But the intent isn't different. The words aren't different. Nothing
sells better
except the cover. Except
it's
sells
the
better.
Marketing.
Yeah. It's the marketing. That's what genres are, is marketing. So they know where to put their marketing dollars and what audience will be most likely to be attracted to it and buy it.
And what's interesting, of course, is that with middle grades and YA, we talk as if they're genres, but they're not.
No.
Right? And in a way, that's actually kind of interesting because, if you go into a bookstore, you've got your mystery and your romance and your fantasy and whatever, and then you've got your YA, which is what exactly? So I think it's potentially really interesting because it means that when you're writing this stuff, there aren't very specific genre guidelines. Because it's defined solely by protagonist age and readership age, so that you can start off writing a book that looks like it's a mystery and then find that it's turned into a fantasy in ways that is much harder to pull off in adult fiction. Because adult editors are always saying, what shelf is it going to go on? And they're envisaging their audience in terms of the subsets of the bookstore. And that's not the case in middle grades and YA. So the book can be lots of different things. It can be its own sort of hybrid. So I think we're going to get more of these sort of subgenres that we were talking about before, which originate in YA, because they can.
Any thoughts?
Do you think this would affect future genres then? I mean, because current YA readers are obviously going to grow up.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
As adults, they're going to expect the same type of things, so maybe they'll be more open in the future to adult fiction being more of a blend as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the rise of this kind of literature in the YA market is coming hand in hand with technological changes and the disappearance of bricks and mortar bookstores. So a lot of those old categories, as these people age, I think are going to break down, and we're going to find it much harder to differentiate, to categorize books, because there's going to be a lot of shades of gray and no black and white.
Yeah, I was going to say, the comments on, especially where you're saying the lack of curse words and stuff, reminded me of, it was a listing from like Harlequin Romance, or one of the romance lines that I read a few years ago, where that was sort of their main categories. You know, when you're aiming for the junior high girls, basically they can hold hands. And then you move into high school, it's okay for them to kiss, but that's it. And it was about five or six very clear sets that, I think it was Harlequin, but it was one of the main lines, was looking at where they were going to put your book, almost based on somewhat the age of the protagonist you were writing about, and how much sexual desires you put into it.
But in some YA, of course,
yeah.
It's
mm-hmm.
wildly different, mm-hmm. you know, from one to the next as to what you can do. And that, I guess that's why we don't have agreement about curse words. And in middle grades, you do.
Well,
but in YA, no.
Well, when you think of our culture, I mean, our culture is so different currently. Junior high, sexually active, you know, there's not much to hide from them at this stage of the game. It's not like, you know, in years past, like when I was growing up back in the late 60s, early 70s, where there was you can't show this or you can't show that because you might influence that age group, you know, into doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Well, you already have these age groups already embarking upon these things in reality land. So your fantasy, as far as targeting a specific audience or what is allowed or considered appropriate for each of the age groups, I think is drastically a gray area.
It's very complicated too, because in South Carolina at least, middle school is 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, all three in the same building, sharing the same library. 6th graders are children. 8th graders are pushing adulthood. And you watch it happen when you work with them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the 8th graders don't want to read Junie B. Jones, and the 6th graders don't want to read things by Holly Black and Melissa Moore. But how can you have them in the same library when you have to have limitations on you know, the age of the reader, and is this appropriate? It gets very, very crazy sometimes.
My roommate is a YA librarian, and she had mentioned that there's actually yet another categorization for called emerging adult that is being talked about. Not young adult, but emerging adult, and that would span the later high school years all the way through college, and into like mid-20s ages that they're talking about as well, because further delineation is becoming is called for by especially a lot of parents who can't or don't control or don't want to read in order to control the books that their kids are getting from school libraries.
Right.
And so that's one of the other.
And you know, that kind of makes me think that it's all going to come to a head, and eventually we're going to have so many delineations that we're just going to say, forget it. And, you know, go back to, it's just books. Here, there are books, read the books.
There's fiction, there's nonfiction. There you go.
You're a kid, okay, read the skinny book. You're an older kid, read the big book.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, I think a lot of it is, I mean, like you said, is to help, you know, parents know, well, I assume there's some common guidelines in here to direct the kids, because most parents will have as much time to read as their kids do. I know my parents never did. But so a lot of it is categorization for, I think some of the aging is for parents, and then the other categorization is really just sort of toward discoverability. It's like, oh, I like these sorts of books. They're all, so I'll go to the fantasy section versus science fiction, which, I mean, sort of an arbitrary distinction when you have a world with dragons that are defending against this thing, and then you find out, oh, those dragons were now engineered from either their lizards over here, all of a sudden you have a fantasy world that was then turned into a science fiction world if you're trying to categorize things. And it's sort of, you know, it's the, you know, any sufficient any technology that you don't understand is magic. So.
Sure. So, what's the next zombie? Okay, it used to be, what was the next vampire? And apparently zombies are the next vampires. So what?
Vampires that make bloody vampires.
And then I get another jag. Thank you. If you're looking for a trend of where, you know, the people who aren't necessarily in the know, who just wander through the fantasy section, are going to see. Yes.
Fairies are going to be the next vampires because publishers, I'll tell you, they contract books, and I don't know for fiction, but for nonfiction, because it takes so long to write, they contract books that are going to be out in 2 to 3 years. And after I had finished the vampire book, they had told me they wanted the demon book, and then the demon book's out, and I wanted to write an angel book. And they're like, no, angels were so 5 years ago. We need a fairy book because they're going to be 3 years from now. So I'm working on a fairy book that'll be coming out in, what's this? This is 12, 13. It'll be out in 2014. So fairies are supposed to be the new thing on the horizon.
You heard it here. Note to self.
Pre-order
yes.
now.
Work.
I don't think publishers have the faintest idea what is going to be big.
I need to believe
them. Well, I mean, you
must.
I mean, Sci-Fi Channel just came out with Lost Girl, which is, again, fairy world.
And it's huge.
Yeah.
They basically say the publishers can put any book they want to on the bestseller list. It's what they're pushing. They decide to push fairies in 3 years. Fairies are going to be big in 3 years.
I think the publishing industry is in a state of crisis. I don't think it knows what it's doing. I don't think it knows how to adjust to the technology. I don't know. I don't think we're there anymore. I don't think that the idea that the publisher can control the marketplace like they used to. I think just in the last 2 years, that has really changed.
Exactly.
There's been a lot of stories of publishers spending huge amounts of money mm-hmm. on books that they have not been able to sell.
Well, I would agree with the fairy, if only for the fact we've got two fairy TV shows, or three. You count Lost Girls on TV right now. So, and from what I understand, they are popular shows. So, you know, anytime something becomes popular, everybody jumps on that bandwagon. Mm-hmm. So I think, at least for a short time, we're gonna see people, more and more fairy stories come out, if only for that reason. Because, you know, anything that smells is popular smells good to everybody, and they, you know, frenzy goes on.
There was a fairy frenzy a couple of years ago, like
right.
when Holly Black came out with Tithe and that series, there were a lot of copied books from fairies already, so I don't know if it's something that is coming in or going away.
Right.
From a consumer standpoint, it feels like it's just anything mythical right now. The last time I was in the YA section at Barnes & Noble, I noticed this rash of mermaid books.
See, that's what
so,
I was going to say.
It just seems to me
the
like it's just... It was their new releases, YA fantasy
yeah.
shelf, and like there was a solid block, 9 books, and I flipped open the ones that weren't blatantly having like a mermaid on the front cover, I flipped it open and it was, oh, this is a mermaid.
Stealth
yeah.
mermaid,
mm-hmm.
as
yeah.
opposed to.
yeah.
Well, they actually had shelves labeled in the new releases, where they had a shelf that was labeled angels, and a shelf above that labeled vampires, and a shelf above that was mermaids.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in Barnes & Noble.
I do think, though, that vampires are not going anywhere anytime
no.
soon.
Yeah.
Regardless
yeah.
of what I think of it. Nobody tell Faith Hunter I said that. She'll hit me. But no, I mean, I think that vampires are still on the top of that food
mm-hmm.
chain. and I don't think they're going anywhere anytime soon. I remember about 5 years ago somebody saying, oh, vampires have they've ridden their crest, they're done. And the next day there are 5 new vampire books. So I don't think they're going anywhere. But I agree about the mermaids, because I've seen short stories popping up occasionally about the merfolk. And with that in mind, you might start seeing Selkies and mm-hmm. the Whiskey Bat.
The Scorpio Races has just come out, and Scorpio Races is insanely popular, and it's sort of about Kelpies.
Is it? I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, it's about the water horses, basically.
Right. The Whiskey Bat.
Yeah, and the Kapil Ishka variety.
Okay.
And the fairies. Sorry
about that. You're talking about, what's popular now, what's coming in, what's going out. And there, what I thought was kind of interesting, how we talked about some of the things like the Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, and things like that. And as popular as these other things come and they go, and they come and they go, and then you have those that stay, like Tolkien, like C.S. Lewis, like and many of the others that we mentioned. And I think that there is something more to their stories than just you have the token trolls, the token dwarves, or the token talking lion, or whatever. There is an undertow, a theme that hits the human psyche, the human heart, that people can relate to. And when you and yes, there are certain things that can be popular or whatever, but what makes, I think, the staying power, like the Wizard of Oz, there are things that hit home and that the reader can connect with and can always connect with, no matter how modern, how technologically advanced you are. You can always connect to the Wizard of Oz on some level, because it just breaks it down into some of the basic human characteristics of overcoming fear and, all these different things that are there. So I think, true to me, what makes a really good fantasy, science fiction, whatever, is a story that hits home with the reader, that will stay with the reader, no matter, that they'll come back to the book again and again to read it and really connect those characters.
Nobody's going to tell Peter Jackson, oh, don't make that Hobbit movie, nobody's interested, because we're kind of over that now.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is something that's going to be ever, which is an awesome segue. What of these works that we're talking about as really modern, as in contemporary right now, fantasy, are going to be the ones in a century people are going to be wanting to make films of? Which ones aren't going to be, disposable, but have staying power? If you could pick, and it doesn't have to be right this minute, it can be the last, say contemporary is our lifetimes. It's modern if it happened after you were born.
Absolutely, Mad Kestrel.
Yes.
If anybody knows Jerry Bruckheimer, come talk to me.
But fortunately, we can still get our own autographed copy before it becomes.
Yes.
I'm right here.
Actually, I would love to see some of Tim Power's work come to screen. Yes, I'm a huge fan, and yes, I push his work wherever I go. But he really writes some amazingly layered stuff. And what he does is he looks at events that took place in history, in real, honest to God history on this planet, and then he tries to figure out what might the magical reasons have been, instead of just, oh, it was politically motivated, what might the magic underneath have been? And so you get these glorious stories that are wonderful, and they're neat because they take place in the real world, in historical settings, and so you can pretend that they might really have happened that way. And I would love to see those come to film.
So. Terry Pratchett.
Yes.
I think Terry's in his last days as a writer, with the Alzheimer's and so on, and I think that we're going to see, it's very sad, but I think we're going to see, when he stops, when he dies, people will finally recognize the seriousness of these books mm-hmm. within the comedy. I mean, I think a lot of us already know this,
that the guy can write and writes well and writes interestingly, and again, sort of brings divergent genres together in a productive way. But I think that will become mainstream, and I'd love to see, you know, a decent, I don't know, a TV series or movie or something come out of those kind of books.
I'm trying to think, like, because I don't read a lot of fiction. I will say I am hoping that somebody decent will do the Dresden Files right. I'm not, because I think the TV show is terrible. But I think what's really important is that when thinking about it, you have to have your main character. And if you don't like your main character, if he's a jerk or whatever, it's just not going to work. You have to relate to them. And once you take away the genre, once you take away the mutton chops of steampunk, the vampire fangs, the spaceships, the dinosaurs, the aliens, if your core character is not something you can relate to and appreciate and root for, it's not going to stand the test of time. That's all I got.
I would say Mercedes Lackey's work.
Anything in particular, or just her body of work as a whole?
I think that she's got a lot of things that could be taken to Belgrade.
Good. This is so incredibly obvious, but I think people will be reading Gaiman's works like American Gods in college courses 100 years from now and trying to understand, you know, modern civilization by going through that. And I also honestly think that Harry Potter is going to be around for a very long time, and it's part of the same phenomenon we were talking about. We're talking about Madeline Lingle or C.S. Lewis or Tolkien or even the ones that came before, because she pulls her building blocks from things that are much older, from the mythology, from the Arthurian stuff. There's just so many lasting things in there. It's a gateway to a whole. It's kind of a cultural literacy test, just reading those works. And so I think that where other works, I don't think Twilight will be studied in 100 years. And I don't mean that in a,
I hope not.
You know, but...
you don't mean that in a what?
Derogatory?
I do.
So what do you think? What works of modern fantasy will be... Yeah.
Well, George R. R. Martin.
Very good time.
Can't argue with either of those. A problem with me studying the works that have been created from Martin's works.
I'm on my A3 reading the series right now.
Wow.
So.
And it's working for you still.
Yeah, and then you mentioned just parts of pulling out culture and stuff. I realized, actually, John, here I was listening to a podcast about Hadrian's Wall. And then it goes to Wall, and then about The Gift in Martin's books, and about how the Romans had that land marked off between the wall, and I was like, dang, there's where he got it from. And so on that.
The works of Paolo Bacigalupi.
Okay.
Those are very, very, like...
The adult, deep, YA, or
both?
Both.
Anything similar to Gaiman, he can kind of do whatever he wants, and it's super good. So, and it's... Stop laughing at my terms. Super good.
He kind of reminds me of if William Gibson and Neil Gaiman had a love child.
Yeah.
It would have been Paolo.
I know.
I don't think I follow biology.
don't. Just it's fantasy. We're talking about fantasy.
Oh, okay.
Last question. What's the best kept secret? The work that you would like to plug that hasn't had the recognition as
Yeah, I'm getting a bit tired of doing best secrets.
Can we recommend our own?
Okay, I'll recommend you and you recommend me.
No, as I would, Alyssa Malcolm. Is an author friend of mine. She has gotten many, many awards, but her work is still not as popular as it should be because she really does. She does a phenomenal job in what she creates, and it's literary. It's almost what you would consider highbrow, but it's the way she writes it. you, it just flows. I mean, it just has a rhythm to it, and it's just so, so lovely. So,
okay. Louise Cooper. She was an English writer. She died some months ago. Huge body of work, but almost nobody I ever run into has ever heard of her. She wrote the Time Master trilogy, which is how I first found her. And it was an amazing trilogy based on the idea that the gods of chaos and the gods of order were always kind of at each other's throats and always trying to find a way to kick the others out, you know, take over. And but they, the one of the chaos lords decides to be reborn as a human just to check things out and see what kind of advantage he can find. Except when he's reborn, he doesn't know who he is. So he spends his whole life finding out. And it was just, it was so different from what I had read prior to that that it blew me away, and I went hunting everything else. And then she did a series about, that was basically, the idea was Pandora's Box, except it was much darker than the fairy tale of Pandora's Box, and Pandora's pretty dark, but it took 9 books to collect all the evil critters that had gotten out, and that was an amazing series too. But Louise Cooper is her name. I highly recommend you go read her after you read mine.
I'm struggling to find something that I would say is sort of unknown. I'm reading Colin Malloy at the moment, Wildwood. I don't know if you know the series. And I have a feeling that is going to be an important book in some ways, because I think it's very self-consciously doing a sort of eco-critical take on fantasy, which I think is one of the directions that we're going to move in. That's all I've got for now.
There's a book Jacqueline Suzanne wrote 100 years ago. Jacqueline Suzanne was probably one of the first women to write all those trashy romance novels in Valley of the Dolls. It's her thing. She wrote a science fiction novel called Yargo. I love it. I don't care for anything else she's written, but this is just like, I like it. It's like one of the characters from Valley of the Dolls is out walking on the beach and she's abducted by aliens. And then it goes from there. And it's I thought it was brilliant, and it was completely lampooned when it came out. And it's one of these books I reread every 3 or 4 years.
Anyone you would recommend?
Scott Lynch.
And why?
Because, I don't know, I love the fact that he's got a fantasy heist novel. And
yes. It's extremely clever writing.
And it's very clever writing. His writing itself is so good. And then he's taken this idea of Robin Hood and undermined it completely, and done a wonderful job of making a character you should hate for what he does, extremely lovable. And
anyone else? Getting our moment here. I've got about 8 till. Is that about right? Okay. So I would just pick up on something that Misty said earlier about different voices coming into this. I've just been excited. My other area is Native American literature or Native American studies, and I've been excited to see that some of the really great current Native authors have kind of moved in that sort of strange, gray, fuzzy area from magical realism or what people would consider ethnic literature, right, that gets stuck over Native American literature sections so fantasy readers never see it, to things that are more identifiable as what fantasy readers are hungry for. And so people like Sherman Alexie and Louise Erdrich have written things that have legitimately been put in the fantasy section and gotten out of that little niche, and that's very exciting. And I'm trying to remember this person's, Drew Taylor something, who recently wrote from a First Nations Canadian perspective, a vampire story, basically an Iroquois vampire story that was just absolutely fantastic. But the idea that you know, that some of these lesser appreciated voices are actually kind of maybe getting a different readership by pulling into the kind of current fascination with fantasy. I hope that's a trend that continues. And I think it's interesting to see some mainstream authors also kind of pulling into that. And PC and Kristen Cast's House of Night series, for example, which is another young adult vampire series, but it's set in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and pulls very heavily, very well researched from Cherokee perspective as well. So you have characters from Cherokee mythology interacting in this alternate universe Tulsa, and even down to, you know, kind of bilingual conversations, which are very well translated, things that you know, your YA reader isn't necessarily getting from, say, Twilight. Although Twilight has its native characters too, just not as well researched. That's the end of the Twilight bashing for this time.
That was a subtle dig.
Have to start the con off well. Very good people, right? Any parting thoughts? We've kind of gone from the origins to what's happening to what we hope will be happening to what we hear will be happening. Any parting thoughts on the genre itself? Why you're there in it? And where it's going in 2 minutes or less?
Since John mentioned it before he fled, you know, I would recommend reading some of the really old stuff. You know, the Shakespeare and the Chaucer and the, you know, read Seamus Heaney's Beowulf. Can't do better than that.
John Gardner's Grendel to go with it.
You were asking about early women writing fantasy. Hope Merlies wrote Blood in the Mist. That's the one I was trying to think of before.
So last name, Merlies?
Mirlees.
Okay. What decade would that be?
30s, I think.
Is she contemporary to, say, Andre Norton?
I think she's a little earlier than that, but I could be wrong. So I can look it up.
And Norton is someone we should have mentioned earlier.
That was a name I was trying to remember.
Yeah,
she
was the first woman to win some sci-fi award.
Marion Zimmer Bradley would be one of, wouldn't she's Audrey Norton's contemporary?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And Norton was the first woman to go to the New York Times bestseller list with a genre book. Mm-hmm. But Bradley wasn't far behind. Good. We haven't had any yet. Parting shots.
I just like to see, you know, more meat on the bones, so to speak, you know, in any of the genres, whether it's science fiction or fantasy, more than just the toys or more than just the trappings of the thing. I always like to have a lot of meat on bones, so that's what I want to see.
When you say meat, you mean like character?
Character, story, theme, what's trying to be accomplished, whether there's just a little bit more substance than just, you know, traipsing through the forest looking for fairies, you know, and getting, you know, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, just something of more substance that kind of either connects to the reader, encourages someone, challenges their thinking on a particular subject, whether that is... And I can't remember and I know this title, I stuck in my hand. Mercedes Lackey wrote it, and it dealt with being gay. The page or something. But it was a fantasy novel about this page and being in the court, and this character struggled with being gay. And it was very well done. It was very well written, and I cannot, for the life of me, I cannot remember the title to this book. But I have heard so many people comment how well it was done, and it dealt with a very serious subject, you know, in our culture. So
yeah,
anytime
a great subject to talk about one of y'all's panels would be gay literature and fantasy, because that.
Mm-hmm.
Not only Mercedes Lackey, but Tanya Huff writes some really great characters in fantasy that's gay.
Yeah, and I mean, it it's, you know, and whether you're dealing with any of the big things, whether it's violence or abuse or neglect or any of those things, overcoming these things, you know, those are really some subject. Even like the, you know, the Lord of the Rings, even though it had the all those different characters, there was a theme, a very intense theme that went throughout there. It was about dealing with power, you know, and power corrupts, and the, you know, and the only way to deal with it is with humility, and just there, you know, so there was a lot of meat in that, and I think that's why it has stand, you know, stood the test of time, that it wasn't just a flash in the pan, here you go, and right. You know, he's just one of those little historical things in the background.
But it had
a message that continues to resonate in our culture today.
Great note to end on. Thank you so much for coming, and appreciate it, and thank you for your fantastic comments, and with this panel, the con has begun. Woo-hoo!
Stay tuned for more StellarCon updates from Raven and Scribe.